It's Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, we'll learn how to make great bagels at home, plus the toppings and spreads to go with them. But first, new data from the Pew Research Center show a big rise in the number of people in the U.S. living in multi-generational households, meaning a home with two parents, their young kids, and perhaps a grandparent. According to Pew, the number of people living in multi-generational homes has quadrupled since the early 1970s, and young men have been a big part of that. Nearly 4 in 10 men in their mid to late 20s are living with older relatives. We're taking a close look at that data and talking about what it tells us about how families and their living situations are changing. We'd love to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. Are you living in a multi-generational household, or have you in the past? What'd you like about it? 1-800-642-1234. We have with us Ariel Cooperberg, an associate professor of sociology and women's gender and sexuality studies at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. She's also chair of the Council on Contemporary Families. Ariel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what do we know about what's driving this increase in multi-generational households?
There's a number of factors. So on one end of life, people are living longer than they used to. Some of them may have higher rates of disability. We also have people who, if you look at the baby boomer generation, they have one of the highest divorce rates of any generation. So more of them may be aging alone. So they may move in with their children for companionship, for caretaking. On the other end of life, it's getting expensive for young people to move out. It's getting more and more expensive as time goes on. People are taking longer to get a good job and be able to afford to move out. Housing prices, again, are, you know, very high, so it's hard for people to move out. Childcare costs are high. So I think there are some multi-generational houses where grandparents may move in and help their kids take care of their grandkids. So there's a number of forces and kind of social changes. And then I think COVID also made things worse, where a lot of people ended up moving back home in part because of loneliness, in part because of job loss, in part because their job went virtual and, you know, they wanted to move back with their family and they could.
Well, and I'm interested. I noticed that this was more true for young men in their late 20s than it was for women. What do we know about why that is?
Well, first of all, women tend to get married younger than men in general. On average, they get married about 2 years earlier. So one factor that may be going on here is that most people tend to move out of their parents' home when they get married. Other things that may be going on, women are now more educated than men are. So women in their 20s may find it easier to be able to afford to move out in some respects. When you talk about the pay gap between men and women, a lot of that pay gap doesn't begin until women start having children. So when they're in their 20s, you know, before many of them have children, they have higher education. Just getting that education, a lot of people move away from their parents' house for the first time when they go to college. And women are now much more likely to go to college compared to men. So again, a number of factors, but all of these add up together.
Sure. And are there regional differences? Does this hold true across the country?
I think it's gone up all across the country, but it does depend on region. So for instance, in the Midwest, these rates are a little lower than some other regions of the country. In part, I think, because the Midwest has relatively lower housing costs compared to places like the East Coast and the West Coast, especially in the Northeast, right? Yeah. In part, people get married a little younger in the Midwest. So again, if you're getting married, most people will move out. If you could afford to move out, you're more likely to move out. Older people may also be able to afford more independent living places because the general cost of living is very low. Childcare is lower than in other regions of the country. So And then in general, also, there are differences in terms of immigrants are more likely to live in multi-generation households, and people of color are more likely to live in intergeneration households. And the Midwest has fewer immigrants and people of color compared to some other regions of the country. So these contribute to why it's a little bit lower in the Midwest. But I think across the board, throughout the country, these rates are going up and have been for a while.
So what does this data tell us about the idea of the nuclear family, the traditional two kids, and how prevalent that still is in America?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of having two kids is still a very strong idea in America. When you say the traditional nuclear family, I would question how traditional that is, because if you look at history, there was only a really brief period in time, really like the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, when it was the norm for people to move out of their parents' house before they got married, for multi-generational households, were kind of at an all-time low. And that was actually a pretty unique period in history. And there were, a few things that made that period pretty unique. So if you look before that, for instance, before World War II, most people lived with their parents until they got married. And the life expectancy was also not very high. 100 years ago, the life expectancy was around 60, right, less than 70. So there weren't a lot of elderly people necessarily living with their children because they weren't living.
Right. We're living longer.
Yeah. So I think, that's also a factor now, too, where people are living longer and longer. Social Security payments are not very high. People have, there's all sorts of health costs that come up that are not fully covered by government programs. And, people are, want to make sure their parents have good care. My own grandfather moved in with my parents before his death because, my grandmother died and, we realized he couldn't take care of himself. So my parents took care of him for a few years. And I think that's increasingly normal as, people like my grandfather who lived until his late 80s, that's an increasingly common experience.
Sure. And so I wonder why were the 50s then an aberration? What caused the interest or the growth in that idea?
Yeah, there were a few things. So a major thing was World War II. After World War II, the soldiers all came home and millions of young men had access to the GI Bill, which suddenly allowed people to go to college who were never able to go to college before. And about 2 million young men took advantage of the GI Bill and went to college. And, we see this huge increase in men going to college. And part of the GI Bill was they gave a living allowance so that people were able to move out of their parents' home. Then when they moved out of, in general, after World War II, the United States experienced a lot of prosperity. They did very well economically for about a decade and a half after World War II. And so people were able to marry very young. The age of marriage dropped to an all-time low. About half of women were married by age 20. And about half of men were married by age 22. So again, if most, half of people are married by the time they're entering their 20s, or at least half of women, and men aren't that far behind, again, those people are going to move out. And there were now these government programs that many young men had that, not only the GI Bill, not only did it open up access to education, it also gave them help with mortgages.
Right.
So there was that. I think there was also, so before World War II, the United States was in the Great Depression for about a decade. And during the Great Depression, many people were forced to live with their family for much longer than they wanted to. The marriage rate went down very low. Age of marriage went up during that time. And more people, we saw an increase in intergenerational households. So I think, and then World War II happened and people were shipping off. But I think afterwards there was kind of a backlash where people were like, well, now we could finally get out and have our freedom. So we're going to, you know, the best thing is to be free. You want to put your parents in a nursing home. We have the freedom to do that. We have the money to do that now. And I think part of it was a backlash to that kind of like a couple of decades of people feeling like they didn't have a choice.
We're talking to Arielle Cooperberg. She chairs the Council on Contemporary Families, and she is with us to talk about why multi-generational households are becoming more common in the United States. You can join in 1-800-642-1234. Are we talking about your family? Do you have a parent or relative living with you? Do you live with them? Do you do that for financial reasons, child care, elder care, something else? Give us a call. 800-642-1234. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. We're talking about the rise of multi-generational households in the U.S. Arielle Cooperberg from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, stay with us. We'd love to hear from you. What does your family look like? What do you love about living that way? Come on, what do you struggle with? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us, ideas@wpr.org. Well, Arielle, I want to dig into the research that you've done on college students and recent graduates moving in with their parents. How much did the pandemic affect this trend?
Yeah, so I collected a survey of college students last April. And about 27% of them, so this was at two universities where I've been doing a study for a while, but last year about 27% said a year into the pandemic they had moved back with their parents because of the pandemic.
Was that the primary reason?
I mean, we directly asked, like, did he move back home because of the pandemic? And we also looked at people who lived with their parents for other reasons. And there were a fair amount of people who lived with their parents before the pandemic. Among students, it was about 46% had lived with their family. We asked, where did you live in February 2020? As a result of the pandemic, this number went up to 62%. So there was, you know, definitely living, the pandemic was not the only reason that people live with their parents in young adulthood. We also found in research that was kind of prior to the pandemic that people are more likely to move back home with their parents after they graduate college. So over half of college graduates in our study move back home within the first year and a half after graduation.
So do you expect that would change as the pandemic lessons, dare I say?
Yeah, I think to some extent. So one thing we found last year was there was a big drop compared to previous surveys that were prior to the pandemic in terms of the graduating seniors in college who said they had a job lined up for after graduation. So I think one reason we may see these trends of people moving back home during the pandemic is job loss, or there weren't job opportunities. Well, now we're in we're kind of in the reverse situation where some places are having problems hiring, wages are going up. So that could mean some reversal in this trend. But in the long run, I think, you know, it's still going to be higher than it was 20 years ago. But I think there was definitely a bump up during the pandemic that hopefully, you know, fingers crossed, this pandemic is soon going to be coming to an end and things will be reversing themselves.
And what do you think the impact of this will be on our housing market, say?
I think one thing we're seeing kind of play out already is that more people are living with their parents for longer, which means parents who previously would have been retiring and downsizing to smaller houses are now staying in those houses. So one of the reasons, you know, people talk about investors is the reason the housing market is so tight right now, for people trying to move into houses, right? But part of that is people not selling their house because their kids still need that extra bedroom because now they're living at home until they're 28 or 30. So I think it's contributing to this tightening of houses. I think on the other end, as more people are kind of having these multi-generational families with their parents, you may see interest in different types of housing that has, you know, they call them mother-in-law apartments, like right. a place in your house that's a little kind of set off from the rest of the house so people could have their privacy, but could also easily reach each other. So I think those might become more popular. And then if fewer young adults are leaving their home, there's also the housing market of the rental market of people selling, you know, renting to college age students and 20 somethings. It's kind of, you know, like rundown apartments we all had in our 20s. Yeah. So those, you know, maybe those will become less competitive.
Yeah, I'm wondering if this trend will continue, if it will start to drive changes in the way our cities look and the way, like you said, zoning has to change to allow for the density required to have space for people living together. But I wonder if this trend is, I mean, it's been happening since the 70s, right? So beyond the pandemic, is this enough to structurally drive changes, or is it too soon?
I think it will eventually. I think we're also going to see things like, because of the pandemic, there was a huge push to embrace online technology. So I think a lot of online courses were developed. There may be more options for distance learning, which may also drive more people to stay home. I think there's been a public conversation about student debt. That's one thing I study is student debt.
Sure.
And there's been a big public conversation about that over the past few years, which I think maybe has made some people question taking out student loans to move away to college, for instance. So I think all these trends are going to continue to, you know, maybe it'll go down a little bit after the pandemic, but in the long run, I think we're going to continue to see an increase in intergenerational households, unless we see major social change, you know, mm-hmm. where you can never tell what happens in the future,
sure.
right? No one could have predicted sure. COVID and all the changes it would make. And I don't think any of us really knows how many of these changes are going to be permanent and how many, you know, will go back to the way things were.
Yeah.
So we'll find out in the next few years, I guess.
And I wonder what you found in your research when you were talking to young people about how the experience of having to live with their families or with their parents, how it kind of changed their perception of adulthood.
Yeah. So many people expect that, you know, you graduate college and then you're going to go off and become an adult and be independent. So moving back home, often for financial reasons in our study, to save money, you know, we focus on people who had student loan debt. So a lot of them were paying off their student loan debt. Felt to many people in our study who we interviewed like they weren't a grown up, right? Like they couldn't be fully adults because they're still living with their parents. And some of them kind of had strategies to feel more like an adult. So some of them, and this is a study I did with my co-author, Joni Mazzellis, who did all these actual interviews. I do more of the survey stuff.
Sure.
But some of them had strategies like they would pay their parents $50 a month or $100 a month and kind of felt like, oh, now it's an equal partnership because I'm paying rent. Some of them paid more. Some of them were giving like $500 a month to their parents.
Interesting.
They would give back help in other ways. But then that led some of them to feel like it was kind of a burden. You know, some of them, one person was helping out with her younger siblings and was basically doing full-time childcare for them while her parents were working. And she felt like that was kind of burdensome, but that she had to do it because she was living with her parents for free. You know, a lot of people felt there was a lot of benefits to it. And we had people in our study who just in 3 years after graduation were able to pay off student loan debt. We had people who were able to save up for a down payment and bought a house within 3 years after graduating. And, you know, a lot of people said their parents were happy to help them out and they wanted them to live with them so that they could save that money. So, you know, there were benefits and drawbacks, I think.
Well, we've got just a minute left, but we have a caller on the line. I'll go next to Sun Prairie, where we've got Steve on the line. Good afternoon, Steve. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm just a little confused by the guest comment. You know, compared to 20 years ago, when we had a lot of baby boomers still in the prime of their career, things have dramatically changed. We've been talking about for 25 years now in manufacturing that we're going to have so many open positions because the baby boomer is retiring.
Okay.
Even in the accounting world, there's not enough accountants that are graduating.
Sure, Steve, we got just
position.
A minute left. I'm so sorry to cut you off, but I'd want to hear Ariel's response to the question of jobs being prevalent and available now.
Yeah, I think you're right. So jobs are available now, but they also don't have the benefits or pay that jobs used to have, right? So that's another reason people are staying with their parents for longer. You're definitely right.
All right. Well, I think we are going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We have been speaking with Ariel Cooperberg. She is a sociologist with the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. She was talking with us today about the growing number of multi-generational households in the United States and what that tells us about how our families and how our communities are changing. Coming up after the news, we're taking your breakfast to New York with a cookbook on how to make bagels, schmear, lox at home. I'm Molly Stentz, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about the work of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection, including questions about presidential records. But now, it can be hard to find a good bagel in Wisconsin. In many communities, you know, your only option is what you can find in that frozen food section of your grocery store, maybe a gas station. But our guest today wants to change that and help us make New York deli quality bagels in our own homes with sweet and savory spreads and toppings to boot. Have you made bagels at home before? What's worked well for you? What hasn't? You can join in 800-642-1234. You can email us ideas@wpr.org. Joining us now, Kathy Barrow, food writer and author of a new cookbook, Bagels, Schmears, and a Nice Piece of Fish, a whole brunch of recipes to make at home. Kathy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Molly. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. Your book goes into some of your family history with food and your heritage. What has bagels meant to you?
Bagels have been central to my family's celebrations since I can remember. Every family get-together, most Sundays, certainly weddings, bat mitzvahs, bar mitzvahs, all of it, there were always bagels there.
And I know some folks may be wondering, and some folks may be being me, is it worth all of the time and attention and the trouble to really make a wonderful bagel? How long does it take?
Well, it takes about 20 minutes in the evening to mix the dough and form the bagels. And then it takes about 20 active minutes in the morning to boil them and put them in the oven. And in 16 minutes, once they've gotten into that hot oven, you'll have a beautiful bagel as though you just walked out of a New York bagel bakery.
Okay, you're making it sound easy.
It's very easy.
So how do we do it? Where do we start?
Well, we start with the central ingredient, which is high gluten flour. This is not a usual flour. It has a very high protein content, and that is what contributes to the very shiny, crackly exterior shell on a good bagel. And in order to get that high gluten flour, we have a couple of options. One is to mail order it from a variety of baking sources, but most often from King Arthur up in Vermont. And if you don't want to do that, you can add a product called Vital Wheat Gluten Flour, which is available everywhere and is very reasonably priced. And you add 2 teaspoons to a cup of all-purpose flour, and you've created that same high protein content that will give you a perfect bagel.
Okay, so we've got the high gluten flour, but what about water? Clear this up for me, because I have heard people say that the quality of your water makes a difference. Where do you come down on that?
I don't know who perpetuated that falsehood, but let me tell you that once, many, many years ago, in order to test a theory, I brought back a bottle of water from New York City, and I tried making bagels, and they just were terrible. So I don't think it has anything to do with the water. It had to do with the fact that I didn't know about high gluten flour at the time. And once I learned about that, it all worked out. Your water will not make a difference, and it doesn't make a difference if it's warm or cold or room temperature when it goes into the mixer.
Okay. So any water will do. High gluten flour. What else?
Well, I like to use a yeast that is called SAF Instant Yeast. And this was a product that was widely available for professional bakers for a long time. And now it's available to home bakers. And it is instant, which means that rather than put that yeast in warm water and worry about whether you're getting enough bubbles, you know, that moment when you like sprinkle the yeast over the warm water and look at it and say, is it alive? Is it bubbling? Instant yeast stirs directly into the dry ingredients. There's no need to bloom it, no need to worry. I love it. So I use the SAF Instant. If all you have is active dry yeast, which you get in the grocery store, that's just fine. You can use that too, but do bloom it first in a little bit of the water. And do not use rapid rise yeast. That just doesn't work.
Okay. So high gluten flour, water, yeast, any other secrets?
2 more ingredients. See, it's only 5 ingredients. The fourth one is salt. I use Diamond Crystal salt, that kosher salt, and it has a sort of large crystal and a good bright salty taste. If you are a home that uses Morton's kosher salt, you'll want to use about half as much. Sea salt is fine. I try to avoid iodized table salt when I'm using any yeast. And the fifth ingredient is barley malt syrup. Now, this is what gives bagels that malty, rich, sweet, yummy scent and flavor. It's the smell that smacks you in the face when you open the door of a warm bagel bakery. And it's very easy to find online. It's a good, often it's found in like beer supply making stores, places like that. So barley malt syrup, very sticky, kind of an annoying product to use, but you only need a tablespoon.
Okay. And specifically barley malt, as opposed to any other kind of sweetener or syrup.
You know, barley malt is what makes them sort of officially bagels. It makes them smell right and taste right. But if you can't find that, I've substituted honey or maple syrup with great success.
Uh-huh. Okay. And then you have to let the dough, you know, once you've mixed it, once you get it, you've got to let it sit and rest overnight, right?
You do. You know, adding that sweetener to that high protein flour just makes the yeast go pow, and the bagels want to just explode like a big balloon, and they will proof in an hour. But the flavor will be like flat. There's just no time for all of the flavors to really develop. So bagels have always been traditionally proofed slowly in the refrigerator overnight. So I have a calendar, a time plan for making bagels if you want to bake them in the morning, or for making them if you want to bake them at night. And that's on one of the pages in the introduction to the book. It's useful if you don't really know what overnight means. Such a weird word, isn't it?
we got a message from Kim on Facebook. She swears by the La Brea Bakery, that's a tongue twister, recipe. Mm-hmm. She says, I make the dough the day before. I give it an overnight long cool ferment in the fridge, or in the winter, put it in the garage. I love hand rolling and shaping them. They freeze great. But frankly, if I have a good bagel shop nearby, Kim says, I wouldn't go to all the effort.
Oh, well, she hasn't made my bagel recipe.
And we should say we have more information available on our website, wpr.org/centraltime. Links to much more information about making bagels. So I'm wondering about the rolling process. So how are you, what's your technique for making them perfectly round?
Well, first of all, let's just give up the idea that they should be perfectly anything, right? If they have a hole in the center, we're good. I use one of two methods. One is the Pokum method, where you have a nice tight ball of dough that you've rolled under the palm of your hand, and you take it and press both thumbs right into the middle and tear a hole through that ball of dough. And then using your two index fingers around one another, you stretch that interior hole a little bit, put your four fingers through the center of the hole, and roll it on the table a little bit to tighten that exterior shell. Mm-hmm. So that's the easiest way to do it. Now, the other way is the way you may have seen bagel rollers in shops do it, and that's to make a rope that you then bring around your hand and seal in the middle of your palm tight, and then roll that seal, that seam on the table. And there are actually people who specialize in this, the bagel rollers of New York. There's a small contingent of them. So, you know, it takes some time to get really good at it, but every bagel's delicious. It doesn't have to be perfect.
I'm with you there. We're talking about bagels, and we will be talking about lox and schmears as well with Kathy Barrow, author of a new cookbook designed to help you make New York-style deli delicacies at home. We'd love to hear from you. Are you able to find good bagels in your area? What separates a good bagel from a mediocre bagel? What kind are your favorite? Sweet, savory, let's hear about it. 1-800-642-1234. You can always email us ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're talking to Kathy Barrow. She wrote a new cookbook, Bagels, Schmears, and a Nice Piece of Fish, a whole brunch of recipes to make at home. I want to hear what you think. Do you have a favorite schmear, a spread, a topping for your bagel? Have you ever tried to make them at home? Let's hear about it. 1-800-642-1234. Well, Kathy, I gotta ask, for those who are gluten-free or celiac, what options do they have for bagels?
I'm very proud of the gluten-free bagel recipe in this book. I worked with a friend of mine who's a pastry chef in Washington, D.C., and after working in a bakery and then owning a bakery for many years, she developed a gluten intolerance. And so she really knows her way around gluten-free flours and helped me develop a recipe that I think is as close to my gluten-filled bagel recipe as it could be. It's very, very delicious and has that crackly exterior shell and that chew, all the things you expect from a bagel.
So what flour do you use?
Well, you use the gluten-free blend that you can find in the grocery store from either Bob's or King Arthur. They're very commonly found these days. And then there are some specialty products that you need, something called modified tapioca starch. It's sold under the name Expandex, and a couple of other ingredients that help you achieve all of that texture.
And levity as well, so that they're not dense.
Oh, they're not dense. They're not. They bounce on top of the water when you boil them before baking, just like a regular bagel. It's really quite remarkable.
Interesting. I will check that out. Now, when it comes to spreads, you start with a master schmear recipe that serves as your base. Tell me about that.
So I know that a lot of people like to buy whipped cream cheese because it's easier to spread on your bagel and it's a pleasing texture. But for me, that product has too many stabilizers and other products added to what is, you know, basically a beautiful dairy product, speaking to all of you out there in Wisconsin. I mean, I love cream cheese, but if I wanted to have that nice texture, I use a trick that my great-grandmother taught me, and that's to add just a little bit of sour cream and a little bit of lemon juice, and then beat the cream cheese with a spoon until it's nice and soft and fluffy. And that gives you exactly what you expect when you open that whipped cream cheese, but it doesn't have any of the stuff in it. And that then becomes the base for a couple dozen opportunities for schmears. And they could either be savory, you know, with chive or some of your leftover lox or olives or vegetables, and or sweet. Like, I have a cannoli cream cheese that's really delicious with mini chocolate chips and candied orange peel. And yeah, that's good. Dried apricot, thyme. I mean, there are a lot of really nice choices.
And so do you prefer to put the toppings in your spreads as opposed to the bagel themselves? Where do you come down on ingredients in bagels, adding things?
Well, there are two sections in the bagel part of my book. One is classic bagels, those that I'm most familiar with. And then another section is called bagels my grandmother wouldn't recognize. And right. That's the one that includes the bagels that have things in them. I mean, there's a sun-dried tomato and Kalamata olive bagel that is the best sandwich bagel you've ever had. It's so good. Even just melting a piece of provolone cheese on top of that makes it a party. So I think there's a place for ingredients in bagels. And if you'd asked me that 2 years ago, I would have given you a big side eye. But I've moved, you know, I've changed, I've learned. I think it's a big thing.
I love it. Well, I want to go to the phones where we have Timothy from Minnesota standing by to join us. Good afternoon, Timothy. What's on your mind?
Hey, good afternoon. I actually had a question about what you were just talking about, really kind of making the leap from different kinds of spreads or schmears for bagels to ingredients. I think my experience, I was in New York City a few years ago, and I think I went to Katz's Deli, and the bagels they were serving there were full of ingredients, and I guess I was shocked because, you know, it was kind of like the sky's the limit in terms of what they would put, you know, and these kind of came out like sandwiches. So hearing that you divided your book that way, when did you recognize that was kind of, you know, the division, or I guess, what have you learned since you started kind of working with it that way?
Ooh, good question.
That's a great question. You know, I knew that I wanted to have a chapter on sandwiches. And as I started to think about great sandwich, my life in great sandwiches, there were some that I remembered on, you know, flavored breads like sourdough with olives in it or things like that, that made me think there was a place for bagels to be the same, you know, to have all those nice ingredients. There's a granola bagel. I really wasn't sure about it, but I thought I'd give it a try. And it's become one of our house favorites. It's just yummy. It's got like cinnamon and oats and lots of little pieces of nuts. It's a wonderful bagel. So I'm surprised.
So you are actually throwing those ingredients directly into the bagel when you mix them?
I am. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. See, I am a classic sesame. I don't know if I can be moved.
Well, it's worth trying. I move people I never thought would move, honestly. My former editor was one of the people who tested some of these recipes, and I would send her a recipe for like a blueberry bagel, and she'd send back a note and say, no. I'd say, come on, just try. And then she did, and she liked it. So you never know.
That must have been a fun perk of the job.
It was a very fun perk.
Well, I got to ask about storage, because after you go through making these beautiful, wonderful, fresh bagels, how do you actually keep them fresh?
Well, first, I'm very happy. I worked really hard to make all of the bagel recipes yield only 6 bagels, which to me seems like a reasonable number. I live in a household with one other person, and it takes a long time to go through 12, but 6 is good. So within 4 hours of baking your bagels, if you can wrap them up and put them directly in the freezer without slicing them, they will stay fresh for up to 3 months. Now, you reconstitute them by preheating your oven, or I use my toaster oven, to 350 degrees. When it's preheated, put a frozen bagel directly on the rack for 10 minutes, and it's as though you just baked that bagel.
Okay. And
the same thing is true if you're buying commercial bagels. Let me just say that.
We've got some emails for you coming in. Grant asks, he says, I've been baking bagels for many years, but I've never used bagel boards. How do you properly use them? What do you suggest?
So in a commercial bagel bakery, bagels are placed on long rectangular pieces of wood, and then they're flipped over halfway through baking so that they bake on both the top and the bottom. The bagels are usually baked in what's called a deck oven. You know them from pizzerias, where most of the heat comes from the top. And that's why a bagel board is required. Now, I worked initially, I was trying to figure out if I had to flip my bagels over. And that's when my husband named everything spice, everywhere spice. Because when I flipped them over, I got sesame seeds and everything else all over the oven and the kitchen, and it was a bad idea from the get-go, I just have to say. So instead, I bake bagels on a hot surface. I take them from the boiling water, put them on parchment that's sitting on a pizza peel. I add my seeds, but I sprinkle seeds on very generously, and then I slide that parchment directly onto a baking steel, which is an all-metal version of a pizza stone. If you don't have either of those, flip a baking sheet over and heat it up with the oven so that you have a screaming hot surface underneath the bagel, and you slide that parchment on it, your bagels are going to cook on the underside as well as on the top.
Gotcha. Well, I've got to ask before we let you go, what is your current favorite bagel?
My current favorite has never changed. It's an everything bagel, untoasted, chive cream cheese, a thin slice of tomato only in season, a nice hefty portion of lox, some capers, and a little bit of ground pepper.
Oof. Thank you, Kathy.
Hungry now, right?
Right. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Molly.
Kathy Barrow is a food writer and author of the new cookbook, Bagels, Schmears, and a Nice Piece of Fish, a whole brunch of recipes to make at home. While it may not feel like spring in much of Wisconsin, the first Tuesday in April is coming up. And we know that means it's time for our spring election. Next Tuesday is Election Day. Voters will cast ballots for nonpartisan races, school board, judges, other local officials. Here's a few things to keep in mind. Ballot drop boxes are no longer allowed under Wisconsin law, unless the drop box is staffed by your municipal clerk. Most cases, you have to personally mail or deliver your own absentee ballot yourself. If you've not yet returned your absentee ballot, you can still vote in person on Election Day. You will need to bring an acceptable voter ID to the polls. If you have more questions about when and how to vote, there's more info online at myvote.wi.gov. I'm Molly Stentz. You're listening to Central Time.